Welcome back to Success Made to Last. I'm Rick Tocchini. This particular show is with Tim Love, and I have now done over 20 different shows with Tim, and I've never asked him a key question about his interaction with Procter & Gamble. And on Sunday, Tim, I was rereading a book that I wrote about when core values are strategic, and I'm rereading a chapter that I did with Charlotte Otto about Procter & Gamble's pivot to becoming a company that was about improving lives. And lo and behold, I read Tim Love and Dick Holt came in and gave the perfect pitch to this idea. Would you tell us about that project and that initiative, and what was the net effect of it?
Well, yeah, it was a highlight for me and my career with Procter & Gamble. It was precipitated in year 2000, right around the turning point of the year, Y2K. The CEO of the Procter & Gamble company was the first time they'd ever had somebody who was not born in the United States as the CEO. And he was extraordinarily intelligent and had all the characteristics of a great leader of Procter & Gamble. Unfortunately, the stock market hit some rough water around January of 2000, and there was some rumors that Procter & Gamble was going to buy Warner Lambert, and some of the shareholders weren't sure that Procter & Gamble should go into healthcare, so there was a little debate going on in the Wall Street Journal and other places, because most of the shareholders of Procter & Gamble at that time were either Procter & Gamble employees or retired employees. So mm-hmm. They're a very strong and formidable voice. And then, like many companies at the time, there was a rough patch, and Procter & Gamble didn't achieve its earnings forecast. And this really concerned a lot of the shareholders, and it was kind of the new era of dot-coms. If you'll remember, there was a newspaper article that asked, is Procter & Gamble relevant anymore? Is Procter & Gamble an old economy company? And all these things in the news media, coupled with the loss of not meeting its earnings report, really shook the confidence of the company. And it also resulted in some of the employees wondering if they were at an old economy company. Maybe they should think of going somewhere else. And that's how attractive the dot-com allure was. I mean, it had everybody thinking, and it obviously we know now that it was an important time, but it went away as a main thing for people to do. But this concern with missing the earnings report and the old economy image, and there were some reorganizing things that Procter & Gamble was doing at the time, really shook the company. And finally, when the next time around, when the earnings report missed again, it was unusual in Procter & Gamble, and this executive decided that it was time for new leadership. So he was replaced, and it was the first time in the 175-year then history of the company that this had happened. And again, that shook the company even more in terms of its confidence. And there was a lot of talk in Wall Street circles and investment advisors that Procter & Gamble should bring in some new blood, somebody from outside Procter & Gamble. And they brought in a young executive from within the company, A.G. Lafley. But prior to A.G.'s coming in, the prior CEO had decided that as Procter & Gamble was no longer going to the retail trade on a division-by-division basis, with the consolidation in the grocery trade in the United States, for example, and with Walmart, they were going to headquarters of their customers, and they were presenting themselves as Procter & Gamble, not the soap division or the beauty care division or the paper towel division. And the executive felt that what the company needed was some kind of internal campaign and presentation of where Procter & Gamble would be presented as a company of brands, not a branded company. And they asked, Charlotte Otto asked, I think, four out of the five agencies at the time to read a research report that was done by a small agency in Cincinnati that showed that companies should be talking about innovation. And that was the way that companies could offset this feeling that the dot-coms were going to take over the world. And so every company had the same research. And you saw major companies like GE and other Microsoft and IBM all talking about innovation. The automobile industry was talking about innovation. And so we got the research, and they gave it to, I was at DMB&B at the time, and they said, would you guys like to work on coming up with a theme for this new initiative for Procter & Gamble? It's not advertising. It's a theme that we can use in our presentations to the trade, and it's a theme that we can use for our own employees that gives purpose to what the company's doing. So I and a creative director at DMB&B, we had 1 week to work on this. They didn't give us much time. And we put together a video like a lot of advertising agencies do using existing footage, and it's called a quick and rough, or it's called a presentation video. And you put music behind it, and generally it's a way that you present an idea in an inspirational and engaging way that helps the prospect understand what the idea is. So we came up with an idea that I had worked with P&G all over the world. So I had I'd lived overseas working on P&G. So I had a very outside of U.S. point of view on what the Procter & Gamble company was. And we came up with an idea that said that every day is new and improved at P&G. And it was a way of saying innovation because it was an everyday relentless pursuit of innovation. And we did a very nice anthemic video. We went out to present it to Charlotte Otto a week later, and we got into her office, and she said, "Oh, Tim, I'm so sorry. Dirk Jager, our CEO, saw something from another advertising agency yesterday, and he really liked it, and we're going to go with it. So I'm sorry that I had you do all this work, but you know it won't be for loss, and we weren't getting paid for this. This is on top of our normal assignments with P&G. And obviously, I was disappointed that we had done the work, and it was kind of like a moot point. So she said to me, "Would you like to see the work of this other agency?" And she was very excited about it because Dirk Jager was very excited about it. And normally, you don't have that opportunity. And normally, I would say, no, I don't really need to see somebody else's work. But I love Procter & Gamble, and I felt like a part of the company, and I'm a shareholder. And, yeah, I wanted to see what it was that attracted them so much. So she put this video in her machine from another agency, and again it was a quick and rough Steel-O-Matic, we used to call them, because you use footage from different things and put a nice piece of music under it. And this thing started to play. And it said, imagine what's next. We developed the first refashionable gathers for campers. Imagine what's next. We developed Target Control Crest, the first Target Control toothpaste. Imagine what's next. We developed Dawn dishwashing, which can cut grease better than any other liquid. Imagine what's next. Imagine what's next. Imagine what's next at Procter & Gamble. And I had a cold chill run through my body like electricity. And I thought, oh my God, I hope they don't do this, but I can't say anything because it'll sound like sour grapes. And she said, stood there proudly and said, so what do you think? My colleague, who was the creative director, he wasn't going to say anything. And I was very conflicted, and I said, oh, Charlotte, I'm afraid that no matter what I say, it's going to sound like sour grapes. But I feel I need to tell you what I'm concerned about, so I'm going to tell you. I don't want to imagine what's next about Procter & Gamble. I want to know. Procter & Gamble to me is like a long-term annuity. You put your effort in and your money, and it will eventually, sure as can be, sure as shooting, will deliver improvement and greater wealth and greater improvement for people. I don't want to imagine what's next, and I've worked with your company too long to know that every single brand in this company has a problem that happens once in a while. And you don't want to be saying, imagine what's next, when you have an experience like lint from a batch of Bounty towels showing on windows that people are cleaning. You don't want to be saying, imagine what's next, when that batch of dishwashing liquid takes the nozzle of the bottle and you can't squeeze the product out. You don't want to imagine what's next when somebody says that the metallic tube for Crest toothpaste is got issues. Mm-hmm. And you don't want to be saying, imagine what's next, when somebody discovers that people are misusing the Rely product and leaving it in too long, and some people died. You don't want to stick your chin out like that. And she said, well, that's what we're going to go with. And I said, are you going to check it out internationally? Because I'm not sure that internationally your people, they need to embrace it. They can't see it as, oh, here's what Cincinnati's telling us to do. And she said, that's good advice. We're going to check it out. We're going to do it. And then I asked her, what did one of the other agencies propose? And she said that agency proposed 99 and 44 100% pure innovation, which was a takeoff on the old ivory bar.
That's right.
99 and 44% pure. But sure. Yeah. Ivory bar didn't exist in the rest of the world, so nobody would know what that meant. And any event, so we collected our stuff, and there was a degree of disappointment that we didn't have a chance to really have our work get heard. But I was more concerned about imagine what's next. And when they started using that in press conferences, in earnings reports, in presentations to the outside world, that was when the company missed its earnings report. And believe me, the shareholders didn't want to imagine what's next. And when they missed the second earnings report and they were still saying, imagine what's next, that was the end. So A.G. Lafley was named CEO, and he came into the company, I think it was in July 1. And I happened to be in the building that day, and I ran into Charlotte Otto. And she said, "Oh, Tim, I just met with AG and he wants to continue with the corporate branding project." I said, "Good," because I knew it was hers. But he doesn't want to use the work that we've been doing. And we want to, the other thing I forgot to put in there was the Procter & Gamble share price went from 115 to 55 overnight when they missed the second earnings report.
That's
so AG came in with this huge cloud, and you know, people questioned whether he was the right guy. Shouldn't they have brought in somebody from General Electric or Microsoft or something?
Not at Procter.
And she said that he wanted to continue the idea of it, but the work, but he was open to looking at something different. And that's usually what happens when there's a new CEO at any company. They want to have something that they can own. And since this had some liabilities attached to it by then, she said, "Would you be interested in working on it, Tim?" And I said, "Well, I would, but I'm not interested in doing what you did last time. I'm not interested in us running around and coming up with a video and putting music behind it and hoping that you and AG like it. You're in bigger trouble than that, Charlotte. You need somebody to come in and work with the existing people that are working on this project that have learned some things. And I'll do that. I'll come in and I'll have our agency come in and work with whoever you want. I don't care who it is. It can be Landor, the design firm, which is another organization. I don't care. It could be a different PR firm because you're in trouble and I want to make sure that we help you." So she asked me if I had the confidence of the CEO I worked with at the time. And I said, "I think so. But why don't you ask him?" So by the time I got back to New York, she had called my CEO and asked him, and he came to my office and he said, "Charlotte called and wondered if you have my confidence." And I told her yes. And I said, "Oh, good. I'm glad to know that.
Check that box."
So yes. We got started on the project, and one of the first things I did, I found out that Landor was doing some interviews with P&G employees to try and get a sense of what they thought the character of the company was. And Charlotte had also hired a guy named Dr. Clotaire Rapaille, a French strategist who had worked on different organizations like the PT Cruiser at Chrysler, and he had done some earlier work on Charmin when Charlotte was in the paper division. And he was a pretty avant-garde thinker, and he'd get people together and have them lay down on the floor and turn the lights out and listen to music and think about when the first time they came across a brand and what was their most recent experience. And it was a pretty funky way of doing things, but I thought it was interesting and worth doing. So I told her we'd work with him and we do these things, but that I wanted to do my own interviews. So I went off and I did some one-on-one interviews with the guys in the maintenance department of Procter & Gamble, the guys in the video department, with people who were in management, with people who were in middle management, with people internationally. Nobody was talking to anybody internationally, but I knew these people, so I talked to them. And I asked them each what they felt motivated them with this scenario. It's 8:30. You've got your hand on the front door of the Procter & Gamble company, wherever you are working in the world. It's raining. Your best friend quit the company the night before, and your recommendation that you've been working so hard on was dropped. What makes you put your hand on that door and go through that door for one more day? Because all of us question the value of what we're doing. All of us wonder, is our work going to be worthy. All of us wonder if we're making the best use of our time. And I want to get at what is it that makes that person at Procter & Gamble continue to go on. And so I asked about 35 people and kept my notes on all this. And then I went to Charlotte and I said, Charlotte, I need to interview Dirk Jagger. And she says, oh, well, no, I mean, he's no longer with the company. I said, yeah, but you know what? I think this company cares about its people. And in 175 years, it's only had one CEO who left. And I think it's important to ask him what he thinks is the essence of Procter & Gamble and what he learned from his experience. And she said, well, I don't really know how to get a hold of him, but his secretary is good friends with somebody in our archives department, and you could ask him. So I did. I went down to the guy in the archives department I knew, Ed Ryder, and I said, can you tell me how to get a hold of Dirk? And he said, yes, he's in Cincinnati. He hasn't sold his house, and he keeps a house in Alabama, and he also has a family house that he keeps in Holland because he's from Holland. And he said, I can ask his former secretary to help you get in touch with him. And then he told me a story about how that secretary had been, her administrative assistant, had been at dinner at a restaurant in Cincinnati one night after Dirk left the company. And some woman in the restaurant, who had had a little too much to drink, I guess, came up to this executive assistant at the table and said, are you the person that worked for that son of a bitch CEO?
Mm.
And it made me very sad. It made me really sad because it made me realize how difficult it must have been for Dirk, being from overseas, being a foreigner in Cincinnati. At that time, he was trying to make changes, and many of the right changes for the company. They weren't wrong strategically. And I felt that I needed to talk to him. So I called him, and I'd had a pretty good relationship with him. I'd gotten to know him a little bit because I worked overseas, and he was always interested in talking to me because I knew his company outside the U.S. as well as inside the U.S. And he didn't have too many agency guys that could do that. Not bragging, I was a victim of circumstances. So I called him and I said, I wonder if I could talk to you. I'm working on the corporate branding project, which you started, and I'd like to meet with you. And he said, well, I could meet with you out at the golf course here, clubhouse outside of Cincinnati in Hyde Park on Friday. And I said, good. And then before Friday rolled around, somebody wanted to see me in the corporate headquarters downtown. And it would have made it impossible for me to go from, like, you know, an 11 o'clock meeting in downtown to meet up with Dirk at 12 o'clock outside of town. So I called him and asked him if it was at all possible if I met him very early in the morning in downtown Cincinnati. And he said, sure. And I said, well, where should we meet? And he said, well, I don't really know what's open then or where we can meet. And I realized I may have been filling in the blanks, but I don't think he wanted to be in a public setting. And he had an office in the Chiquita building next to the Procter & Gamble headquarters. John Pepper and some of the other retired executives also had offices in the Chiquita building. And he said, I'll tell you what, why don't we meet in my office at the Chiquita building at 5:30, and I'll bring donuts and coffee. Mm-hmm. And I said, great. And so I went and I talked to him for about 3 hours. We had an incredible conversation. It was just sobering about his, you know, his feelings and his love of his company, his career history, what he thought the character of the company was, and where he thought its competitive advantage was in its character. It was invaluable. And I thought that needed to be part of my summary. And I can tell you one thing, when people found out that I had interviewed Dirk, everybody wanted to read the summary. I can send it to you. Send it to you. Yeah. Anyhow, we came up with collectively this group of Landor and Clotaire Rapai and the brand people that were on it, came up with an idea that said that this is a demanding yet caring company. It is extraordinarily demanding, but it is also caring. And that's what makes it different. The other things that make it truly different are its promote from within policy. It's the only company that I knew that had a promote from within policy any longer. Nobody, no other company in America except a family-run business had a promote from within culture. And I had worked at a promote from within culture when I started my career. So I knew the value of that. I knew that when I got a job offer from Dancer Fitzgerald Sample, that it was a hard-earned job offer. It was an honor. And when I started at my first orientation at that promote from within culture, I was gathered together with other recruits who were equally promising as I was. And I knew that one of us could possibly be the CEO of the Dancer Fitzgerald Sample Company someday, because nobody would ever come in from outside. I wouldn't go to work one day and find out that my boss just can't quit and the new guy came in from Chevrolet. Mm-hmm. That's a huge, huge cultural advantage, because what it does is it enables people to be encouraged to innovate, and that they if they make a mistake, they're not going to get fired, because you learn more from your mistakes than you do from your victories. And they wanted people who were experimenting and being innovative. And for the Procter & Gamble company, the way you'd lose your job is if you made a mistake and you didn't tell anybody. If you made a mistake or something didn't work and you did it again and again and again, they encouraged you to learn, to test, to fail, but to learn from those failures. And that was a huge point of difference in the character of the place. And the other thing that I thought made the company very different was the heritage of the company and its history, how it innovated over the years, and moving from a soap that floated to, you know, shortenings that revolutionized the way people could fry foods, first toothpaste with fluoride. And these were projects that took years and years of dedicated action to bring to people's lives. The other thing that I thought from my experience, I had worked on Always feminine hygiene pads, and I had been in charge of that brand as it rolled out across the world from the agency standpoint. I'd also worked with Pampers, and I had the good fortune to see what those products that seemingly don't seem that sexy, like perfumes or jewelry or a hot car, I got to see what difference those products made on people's lives. I could see how a bar of soap, Safeguard, could eliminate bacteria on people's hands. Mm-hmm. I realized how Ivory bar soap, because it floated, was more convenient. You didn't have to search around in the dirty water for the bar of soap. It was right there where you could reach out and hand get it. I saw how Pampers enabled fathers to participate in the bringing up of their children, because, you know, it didn't require safety pins and the father wasn't going to stick the baby. I saw how Always could enable young women who had just started menstruating at age 13 or 9, anywhere in the world, could continue to go to school and not have to stay at home. So I was a huge believer in that. You know, people always wanted to work on fast cars and fancy perfumes and things like that that were, or Coca-Cola or Pepsi or whatever. And I worked on everyday household products that improved people's lives every day in little tiny ways. But every day they made life a little better. And for me, the reason why I would put my hand on the door and go through it was that I had a client who had a promote from within culture, and they didn't play games. They weren't dishonest. They were straight with me as if I was straight with them. And they made wonderful products that were consistently good, that improved people's lives in small ways, but they were huge, huge. When you think about what a Pampers could do and enable a woman to drop her child off at a child care center and work or go back to school. And so that and the interviews helped influence the development of a campaign, not a campaign, but a video. And the video was intended to show as many of the Procter & Gamble great brands as it could. And well, we had trouble coming up with a line. And we tried, you know, everything we tried. We had hundreds of lines. And the day I went out to Cincinnati to show the final board with the line that we were going to finally recommend, I got in at Cincinnati Airport. And as I went out to get in the taxi cab, Dick Holt called me. And he was the writer. And Dick said, "Tim, I think I have a better line than the one you have on the board." And after hundreds of lines, I'm going to myself, who knows? You know,
right.
Pick one. And he says, here it is. Touching lives, improving life. And I said, that's it. That's what they do. That's it. It's perfect. So I went out and they agreed that that was a good line and we should do the video. And I went off to get myself some surgery on my ankle. I had broken my ankle and I had to have it rebroken and reset. So I used that time to go in and get my surgery. And when I came back to work on crutches, they were ready with to show me the first edit of the video. And they asked me to come over to the writer and the art director, Dick Holt, and I can't remember his name right now, Carew, asked me to come over to the studio and see the edit. And they were very proud, and they were very interested in what I thought. And I went in, and I sat down, and they rolled the video. And it looked like it was an only U.S. company.
Mm-hmm.
They showed houses like in Connecticut and the suburbs of Cincinnati. They showed very little diversity in the company. It didn't look like the Procter & Gamble I saw all over the world. And it looked like, you know, a U.S.-centric point of view. It looked like Ozzie and Harriet. And I said, do you have any other footage? And they said, we got tons of footage. We got all the footage from every brand all over the world. And I said, okay, we need to make this look more like the real Procter & Gamble. It's far more diverse. It's far more international. Half of their sales now are international. And it's going to be more as they roll out into the developing world. We've got to make this look like the Procter & Gamble of today and tomorrow. And it's an inspirational thing. So we have to figure out a way to disrupt the video with questions like, what are you doing today? What is your purpose? What difference will you make? And so we sat there, and I laid down on the floor with my crutches, and we sat there for 8 hours and re-edited the whole thing. And I'm telling you, when it was done, I had tears in my eyes. And we sent it out to Cincinnati, and I called Charlotte and left a message on her voice machine. I said, it's the best thing I've ever done, and it's the best thing I've seen from the Procter & Gamble company. She called the next day, and she said, Tim, you guys did it. And long and short of the whole thing was, it was never intended to be an advertising campaign. It was only intended to be used, you know, initially to underscore AG's leadership and what he was doing. They ended up using the video for 5 more years.
See?
I couldn't believe it. I wasn't even working with him by then. I was over in Japan working with Nissan Automobiles, and they were still using the video, and they were using the line. So it was the product of a lot of good people working together who really cared about the company. And it was the product of some people who had a good idea, but stumbled on it and realized they needed something more emotional and more true about the company. And touching lives, improving life, inoculates somebody in the same way that Think Different inoculated Apple. Apple could have said, we think different. And that's a different tonality than Think Different.
Mm-hmm.
So if they go out and they're espousing this ideal of Think Different, and they have something that doesn't quite make it, well, at least they were thinking different. You know what I mean? I share their value. And touching lives, improving life, that's what you're all about. I know you're not going to be perfect, but boy, I can't disagree with that modest, humble purpose.
You got it. And it's got such few words, yet such lasting, timeless meaning. And if you went to the P&G site today, there's a bullet point. Actually, it's in a big blue bullet point. It says, we believe in finding small but meaningful ways to improve lives now and for generations to come. And it's given them a soul and something that every single person, regardless of where you work for Procter, now in its 66,000th day as a company, has this lasting, timeless, universal approach to business. And it provides.
I'll say one other thing that maybe people didn't realize, because what also contributed to this vision was John Pepper had worked on something called the PVP, Principles, Value, and Purpose. And when he retired the first time, it kind of got put over on the side. And when he came back after Dirk left, John came in as chairman and AG came in as CEO. You remember that?
Yes.
John was asked to come back in and be chairman. He picked up the PVP again. And he really made it part of the culture. He asked people what they thought of it. And that principles, value, and purpose was a statement that was in every single office of Procter & Gamble all over the world, wherever I went. And I think that helped inform the campaign a lot. That was a very important piece of the puzzle, is having a codified principles, values, and purpose. And I think they're still using it today.
They are. It's posted right on their website. Tim, just to wrap this up, and I dearly appreciate that inside story on that, what's the challenge to companies, big and small out there, to know themselves and to occasionally give themselves an examination of their heart and soul to make sure that they're being true to themselves and that they're actually walking the talk and that they understand themselves and their relationship to all the stakeholders and everyone else in the world. What's the value of just stopping and pumping the brakes every once in a while to make sure that they are aligned?
Well, there's, you know, everybody knows now in most companies that you've got to have a purpose. And when the work started on having a purpose, I thought, oh boy, this sounds like another McKinsey,
yep,
you know, deck. And at first it was vision, as George H. Bush said, that vision thing. And then it was a mission statement. And all the consultants went around and helped every company have a mission statement. So when this thing started with purpose, after P&G did the campaign and got turnaround on its business, a lot of people wanted to know about purpose, and it's still being talked about, and there's consultants who specialize in purpose. But I do think that there's a difference between your purpose, your vision, and your mission. I have a harder time seeing the difference between vision and mission or objective. But purpose is something deeper. Purpose has to be true in every aspect that you experience when you're in the presence of somebody from P&G or in the presence of a brand from P&G. It has to connect. And that purpose can't be concocted. It has to be true. For example, one of the things I learned when I worked internationally was in a lot of the third world countries, for hundreds of years, those markets were markets where major manufacturers of clothes or household goods would dump product. In other words, if they had a bad batch of a product, or it had a glitch in it that might not look right, but you know, had an error on the manufacturing line, it was still a good product, they would go to another market and sell it cheaper and dump it. Mm. And so the consumer in the third world was used to seeing first world products from time to time, but they were never there on a sustainable basis. They go to the market one day and it would be there, and the next day or the next week or the month after, it wasn't there anymore. So one of the things that Procter & Gamble brought to the party was a consistency of availability,
mm-hmm,
and consistency of quality. That was unusual, to have a laundry detergent that you could use to wash your clothes by hand that was there and consistently the same quality. So that long-term, that reliability was something that was just so instrumental to the purpose. The other thing that I would say makes it tough for some companies to get a purpose is, you're going to hear about it in one of our upcoming episodes with Tom DeLong, a professor at the Harvard Business School. Tom is a real master of leadership and understanding. He believes that authenticity is important to leadership, and that you need to be maturely vulnerable.
Yes.
I love that. You have to be maturely vulnerable. If you're not, you won't see the need to change.
Mm-hmm.
Your ego or your arrogance or your short-term threats may get in the way of you seeing the right thing to do. And that was the other part of Procter & Gamble's ethos, is do the right thing.
You got it.
It's one thing you hear inside of Procter & Gamble when you work with them. Ultimately, let's do the right thing. And sometimes the right thing is hurtful, but you do the right thing for the consumer. And the consumer is boss was a big thing that AG had, which also said, you're going to suspend your ego and be empathetic and loyal to your consumer. They're the ones, they're the boss, not your boss here in the building, the consumer. And there's a mature vulnerability to that. So I think that that was encapsulated into Touching Lives, Improving Life.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, one last story, just quickie. I'll try and do it real quick. So we were ready to go. The company set up to have a world P&G day. And they, in those days, they didn't, the internet wasn't to the point where you could ship videos as easily as today. So they made a gazillion half-inch cassettes for every office in Procter & Gamble around the world. And it's not a gazillion. It was probably, you know, a few thousand, those little half-inch cassettes. And they were going to send them out. And then the following week on Tuesday, they were going to have the day where every office in every Procter & Gamble country was going to play the video. And on the video, it would be A.G. Lafley talking about Touching Lives, Improving Life. And I was in Cincinnati doing some focus groups up at the King's Conference Center up at University of Cincinnati. And our account director called me. And she said, "Tim, we have a problem." I said, "What?" She said, "Well, there's some people at the headquarters there in Cincinnati that think that this would be a real big mistake if they run this video and send it overseas. And their belief is they're telling people that they think AG shouldn't do this." And I went, "Holy cow."
Mm.
But for some reason, I knew exactly why they were saying that. It was the same thing that happened to me when I sat on the floor in the production studio and saw the video that looked like Ozzie and Harriet. It wasn't Procter & Gamble. The people in the production studio at Procter & Gamble, very few had ever been overseas. They've only worked in Cincinnati. So when they saw the finished video with Chinese things and African things and French things and Russian things, and well, that wasn't their Procter & Gamble. And I thought that must be the problem. So I said, "Tell them that I'll come over there after the focus groups and tell Charlotte to have all the people who were raising the issue to come and we'll look at the film together." So I was on crutches. So I come walking into this room with about 25 different Procter & Gamble people, and I knew them because I always was the kind of guy that would go behind the back in the back room of the studio and ask them about their job and what they were doing. I was curious. I wanted to know how they did things in the studio behind the screen. So they knew me, and I walked in, and I sat down, and I said, "I understand that there's some concerns, and I think probably maybe we should, you know, we should look at it together so that you can tell me what your concerns are, so because maybe I'm missing something." So the guy went, put the cassette in up the front of the room in front of the 25 people, and I said, "Wait a minute, before you start that, I said, I'm just wondering, how many employees are there in the Procter & Gamble company today worldwide?" And they said, "Was 130, but after SG strengthening global effectiveness, after that initiative, there's about 115,000. I said, "Yeah, I think." "How many of those people speak English?" And they said, "Well, this business is done in English. I'm sure that pretty much everybody has to speak some English." And I said, "And how many do you think English is their first language?" And the room was completely quiet. And somebody said, "Well, probably half, maybe less than half, because we're such an international company nowadays." And I said, "Let's look at the tape."
There you go. Case closed.
There was no problem. And I'm not bragging. It was just, I knew how they felt.
Yep.
I knew how they felt. And they had a right to feel that way. And I told them afterwards what happened when I did the editing. I told them exactly what happened. And I told them, and, you know, I'm from Ohio. They knew that I knew what they were looking at. And they also knew that I had seen a different world of Procter & Gamble. And they respected that, which was wonderful for me.
Love it. All right, Mr. Love, I appreciate you. Thank you for taking the time to do this on our Success Made to Last show, and looking forward to our future Discovering Truth series. And we thank you. And I really, truly appreciate your friendship and all the wonderful people you've introduced me to.
Well, thank you. It's not often I get asked these great questions, and of course I get excited. So, but that was a good story.
It was indeed. Thank you. That was Tim Love, our friend of this network, and we hope that you enjoyed this Success Made to Last show. And as we always say, may you continue to live the best version of yourself. Have a great week. So thanks to our sponsor, Edward Jones. They are our trusted financial advisor. And Edward Jones has been instrumental in helping us pivot our lives built around health, happiness, travel, and adding value to other people's lives. You can contact our advisor, Serban Marasini, by emailing him at serban.marasine@edwardjones.com. And thanks again to their sponsorship of this program. And thanks to our sponsor, Gracefully Yours Greeting Cards, and their hilarious Church Kitchen Lady cards. Church Kitchen Ladies are a bunch of maybe 20 million volunteers across the United States that work in 300,000 churches, and they say stuff like, mind your own biscuits and life will be gravy. They also say, crunch tacos, not abs. And psst, you're crazy is showing, you might want to tuck that back in. And one of our favorites is, life is short, lick the bowl. If you want to find out more about the wonderful Church Kitchen Ladies and join their roundtable, go to gracefully-yours.com today and find out about Church Kitchen Ladies and purchase all the rest of the fine Gracefully Yours greeting cards.